Thank you. Kia ora tātou. Yes, thank you for that introduction. And nice to see you and nice to be with you today. Thought I should tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in Hastings. Yes, Hawke's Bay. Oh, come on now. No better place to be. So I grew up in the Hawke's Bay. My parents took me off to Bible college when I was 6 months old. So I started early. They went to Faith Bible College in 1979 with me as a little baby. They had become Christians, converted out of the hippie movement in New Zealand, and through the charismatic renewal, found Christ, become Christians, and had children and went off to Bible college, and still pastoring an AG church down in Palmerston North. So I grew up in Hawke's Bay for most of my younger life, watching baptisms on the bank of the Tukituki River. For some inexplicable reason, you always had to dress in white for baptisms back in the 80s, which is the worst colour to wear when you go dipping in the water. Those lovely white gowns that were worn in the river. We spent a few years in Morrinsville when I was a teenager. Not so many shout-outs there, guys. In the Waikato, if you've been through Morrinsville. And then when I was 18, I moved to Auckland and to go to university, and here I have stayed, if I'm here. Am I still in Auckland? Yeah. Technically? Okay. Good. Just. So I've grown up in the church, particularly in Pentecostal charismatic Christianity. That's been my experience of life. And I continue to be involved with that, lecturing at Alpha Crucis, participating in church life, and married to one woman named Hannah. She is wonderful, and she supervises a social work team in Women's Health at Auckland Hospital. So she's involved there, and her work stories are much more dramatic than mine, and probably mirror some of yours more than mine do. You know, sometimes I'll come home and complain that my document didn't save the way that I had hoped. And her dramas are escalated somewhat from that. But yes, she's wonderful, and I'm very appreciative for her holding my life together, along with the Lord, obviously. Let me just pray, and then we'll get into a few things I want to talk about. God, we thank you that you are present among us, that you are closer than the breath in our lungs, that your spirit moves in our conversation, in our story, in our testimony, in our community with one another. May you continue to be present as we reflect and think and discuss and challenge ourselves. May you draw us forward into the kinds of people that you desire us to be, so that we might participate in what it is that you're wanting to do in the world around us. Amen. So you're going to hear a bit of me this afternoon, so hopefully that goes all right. I'm going to talk in particular about faith, Christianity, theology, and culture. And it's going to be no surprise to you, I'm sure, already, but I am a white man. If that's been a surprise, it's okay. But I am. And so I'm aware that there's a certain irony to coming here as a white middle-class man and talking about culture and cultural difference and all of that, but bear with me in that regard, and I'll try and stay within my bounds. Because our position in life shapes the way we see the world, shapes the way we understand our own story, and the way we understand one another. And so my perspective is inevitably shaped by my own story. We were just hearing Mary talk about her story, which I had the privilege of hearing in January as well. So that was good to hear again. You know, all of our stories in this room, which is a smallish number of people who all share a bunch of stuff in common, and yet still our stories are all wildly different from one another. And the way we see the world is quite different from one another. So I guess I'm just acknowledging that straight up. Now I want to talk about culture. So I'm going to do two sessions with you this afternoon. The first one is more broadly around the church, culture, how we think about our faith in terms of those issues. And then in the second session, I want to focus in more specifically on the impact of culture on social realities and what implications that might have for ministry and for chaplaincy and so on. So that's where we're going to head. So I've titled this Christianity, Cultural, Countercultural, or Acultural, and hopefully that'll make some sense as we go along. The question of culture is emerging as one of the most potent issues in the world right now. You do not have to look very far, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, that the world is an interesting place in 2017. I think the last 18 months in particular have been pretty fascinating. That might be one word for it, in terms of what's going on in the world. And a big part of what is happening is that the world has changed in a number of ways. Globalization, mass migration, technology, access to other people's lives at the swipe of a thumb or a finger or a click of a button or whatever. Clicks of buttons are pretty outdated now, actually. It's swipes of your left thumb before you get RSI and you have to switch over to the other hand, the old phone there. But the world has changed quite quickly, and that has caused all sorts of issues to come to the surface. There's this rising multicultural reality, which is having an interesting impact on 21st century society. And I think one of the things that many people assumed is that with mass migration and people moving all around the world and increase in technology, we'll all just learn to understand one another much better than we did before. We'll all be living side by side, holding hands and singing our way into the sunset. Of course, what's happened is that the kind of complex and difficult relationships that were held at a distance for quite some time, they were there, but they were held at a distance, have now come into each other's neighbourhoods. You know, so our fear of the other, which in some ways we could comfortably avoid thinking too much about in the past, has now reared its head in quite potent and potentially destructive ways. Obviously, you know, without having to name all of the things, the Trump phenomenon, and if we call it that, in the US, the Brexit surprise in the UK, and then the UK again today is in all sorts of flux, let's say that. Things are quite unstable politically, and a lot of the unstable politics is not actually about left and right. That's been the traditional framework, at least for my lifetime, has been politics has all been about left versus right. But now what a lot of analysts are saying is that politics and the political instability and the flux that's going on is really more about tribalism versus multiculturalism, and people who want to expand and open up and see the world that way, and people who want to say, no, we need to protect something of our culture and our tribe and our people. And that's one of the conflicts that's going on in the world. I was in Missouri in March for a conference where I was presenting a paper over there, St. Louis, on the banks of the Mississippi there. Has anyone been to St. Louis, Missouri? A few people. Fascinating place to be at the moment. We walked through the middle of the city, in the CBD, in the middle of the day, on a Wednesday, sky,
high-rise buildings everywhere.
And yet, I think during our maybe 1.5 hour walk around the city, in particular around the CBD, I'd say I could count on one hand the number of people we met walking in the other direction. It was like a ghost town in the CBD in St. Louis, right? And the population in the last, I'm not sure exactly how long, maybe 10 or 20 years, has dropped from something like 950,000 just in the inner city area there in the CBD down to about 200,000. So, and St. Louis as a city and Missouri as an area is built on factory manufacturing. That was the lifeblood of their prosperity and their source of strength as an economy in that region. And many of those jobs have gone. And so people who were earning a good wage working in manufacturing and now not working or working in Walmart for less than, they don't have a minimum wage. So that in part has been caused by the changing world, by technology, by globalization. Now, the aim of that story is not to say that those things are good or bad. It just is. That's the reality of the world we're living in and have to negotiate. We were staying a few minutes from Ferguson, Missouri, which is where, if you watch the news 2 years ago in particular, there was a young African-American man who was shot and killed and left in the street by the police there, where the Black Lives Matter movement really originated. And so you're living in this paradox, or we were staying in this paradoxical kind of area where you have a state that voted for Trump overwhelmingly, staying right next door to a suburb that is poor, African-American predominantly, and suffering, and all of this is swirling in the air, and all of these issues of race and culture and globalization, and all of that is playing into what's going on in that local community, and that's playing on at a large level as well. Now, New Zealand is not immune to all of that. We continue to have our own wrestles with culture, with biculturalism, multiculturalism, with migration. You know, the debate is rising again in New Zealand. Even how do we negotiate what it means to be New Zealanders, for example? Well, that's a contest. You know, although people throw around that phrase, what we mean by that phrase might differ quite profoundly depending on who you are and what cultural, ethnic background you come from. So this is complex, is what I'm trying to say. The issues of culture are important and complicated, and not necessarily easy to navigate our way through. More broadly as well, I think, as the church, then we talk about the culture we live in. So we use that word to describe the broader sense of the cultural framework or the culture of our society. So we'll talk about New Zealand culture, even if that's a very simple term for a very complex reality. We'll talk about the church and its attitude towards the culture culture around us. But even that, as I've mentioned, that idea of the culture around us itself is not perhaps as easy to identify and understand as it has been at times. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes the way in which that culture has been defined has been quite marginalizing for people who don't find themselves in the center of that story. So, all of this is swirling around. So what do we do with this? How do we negotiate this as people then, trying to follow Christ, trying to minister in a way that makes a difference in the world? How do we navigate this? So I'd like to talk about that kind of stuff. Is that all right? Yeah? That's lucky, because that's what I'm prepared. You're like, no. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Here's a statement about at least some of what culture entails from... there's a very famous book called Christ and Culture by H. Richard Niebuhr. There's a few Niebuhrs, so if you're ever reading Niebuhr, you have to just check which one you're reading. They're all related. But this is from a book called Christ and Culture. It's probably a bit dated now, but there are some useful threads that still run through this. It's written much earlier in the 20th century. But he talks about these things in particular as being inherent to what we mean when we talk about culture.
So this is about language, about habits, ideas, beliefs, customs, social organization, inherited artifacts, technical processes, and values.
So when we talk about culture, we're talking in many ways about what it is that makes that shapes our human experience in the world. Human experience is inevitably cultural, because those things there encapsulate how we live. A Latino theologian by the name of Nestor Medina says this, which is the next quote there. Culture is the unique, concrete... This is a more contemporary definition of culture. Culture is the unique, concrete, socially constructed, universal frame that provides entire communities and their members with the necessary skills and materials for creating a comprehensive, cohesive view of the world and reality. So culture is a weird thing because it's socially constructed, right? We create culture together. It's not something that gets bestowed upon us as such, you know, you don't. As a middle-class white New Zealand male from Hastings, I am not drawing down on some kind of abstract set of cultural values and sort of applying them to my life. It's something we create, we have created together, the things that form our culture. And it's always shifting and changing. It's a dynamic process. There is no static culture. It's always undergoing flux and change as it responds to the various, as we respond to the various things that crop up in our reality. If you think about the idea of language, language is a critical part of culture. On a very base level, language is the way, say, we communicate with one another. If we couldn't speak and understand language, we'd find it very difficult to communicate. So in that sense, we're very grateful for large parts of our brain that have grown in the old neocortex, I think it is, there, that have enabled us to form language and to form ideas using language. So we communicate through language. We have agreed terms and meanings. You know, if I'm talking right now, obviously the reason you can understand me is because we share a vocabulary together. I'm saying words, you know what those words mean, but you're also hearing my words, putting them in context with the words that are around them so that you can understand, and you're doing it all very, very quickly. It's quite impressive if you stop and think about it. And if you've ever, does anyone speak more than one language? Anyone more than one language? A few of you? You'll realize language is complex. Sometimes when you're speaking in one language and you try and translate and you find there's not a word. There's no word for that, right? Which tells you that language is not just how we communicate with one another. Language is also how we make meaning. Because if you don't have a word for that, if you're actually from a culture where that's the language you speak, you don't even have the idea of that. Because you can't have the idea for it if you don't in some way have the language or words to put to it. So language actually helps us make meaning in the world. And that's not just true of... Oh, that was the next picture. That was language. There it is. It's amazing. And then the next one, which is technology, symbols, artifacts, which have shifted and changed over time. These also are the ways we engage in the world in which we live. So, I'm reading this off an iPad. I've got my iPhone here for time. I'm speaking through a little technological gadget that enables you to hear me without me yelling. All of those things are kind of practical and useful, but they also start to shape the meaning I make of the world themselves. So, I've got a phone that enables me to communicate with people who I can call. But now this is more than a phone, right? This is now a smartphone. So it's got internet capabilities. Obviously, it doesn't just have Snake the game anymore like the old Nokia did. This enables me to do all sorts of things and check my email and my tweets and my Facebook and my Instagram and read the news 5 times too many each day to update my budget, to, you know, check if students have submitted their assignments, to make sure I'm up to date with how we're going on the cricket and the weather. So there's all sorts of stuff going on here, and I can really Netflix if I want to, right? All on this little device, which is quite amazing. Now, that's amazing technology that enables me to live in the world, but it actually starts to shape the meaning I make in the world as well. So I engage in social media, for instance, as a way of connecting with people, but over time that becomes a way I actually understand reality, understand the world, perhaps. Perhaps I start to attach some of my value to the way in which my social media is perceived, right? Do you think about young people today especially? Like, I'm an adapter to this technology because I'm a little bit older than the youngsters. So I can use it. But I think about young people today who are growing up immersed in this kind of technology. This is not just tools they're using, like maybe someone my age. Their whole world is being shaped. The meaning they're making in the world is being shaped through the technology, the media that's at their disposal. So that actually changes the way they see the world and understand the world. What is a friend? What does it mean to like someone or something? These are all words that are changing before our eyes. And what does that do to the way we see reality? Now, if we're a bit older, we might just complain about that. That might be the best way to handle it. It's not like it used to be. This is terrible. But every generation complains about the younger generation coming through and that they don't really understand the way we did, and I had to walk, you know, to school, and they'd get dropped off in four-wheel drives, or, you know. We're always aware of the differences for the generation that's coming through, but I think it's more helpful sometimes not for us to just characterize as good or bad, but to try and understand and to say, what's happening? What is changing? And what are the implications of that change for us? And what are the positive and potentially negative implications of those changes, and how do we navigate that? So all of this goes into what we're talking about when we talk about culture. Sociologists Berger and Luckman have a book called Social Construction of Reality. Now, I'm not a sociologist. I'm a theologian who dips my foot in sociology from time to time. So if you're a sociologist out there, sorry for probably ruining sociology. But anyway, Berger and Luckman have a book called The Social Construction of Reality, which is really about how, at least in a very broad sense, how we create reality together through our social interactions. The way we make meaning together actually defines the way we see the world. Which is all very interesting, and perhaps as we talk about it, we're like, yeah, I can get that. And then we say, well, okay, as Christians then, what does it mean for us to make claims about reality that transcend culture? So, for example, we make a claim about God. I think Mary was talking about a meta-narrative, and this big story that's shaping our view of reality. There we're saying, are we making some claims that this is not just our particular cultural view of reality, but in saying that there is a God, that inevitably, immediately, if we're saying that's the God, is a claim not just about a local perspective, but that you're making a universal claim of some kind. Make claims about what that means for the world, about right and wrong and morality and ethics and values. So I get the sense, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but as Christians, generally speaking, we're saying that this stuff is more than just our particular perspective shaped by our culture that we've kind of formed together, we've just developed over time a certain way of seeing the world. Many of us talk about actually encountering God in some kind of way and being transformed by that story, and that in fact everybody should encounter that God in some kind of way and be transformed by that story. These are bigger claims that we make as Christians, and so how do we think about that in light of culture and the way we form reality together in communities? The way that I, as a New Zealander, see the world is very, very different to the way many people today see the world. So how do I speak about Christian faith in that kind of context? Peter and I were chatting just over at lunchtime about the change the church has had to undergo going from being the center of Western society where everybody looked to the church and the church was authoritative in the community, to now a time where we're a pluralistic society, at least to some degree, whereby there are multiple religious and cultural voices in our community. Now, we could lament that change and say, wouldn't it be great if we were a Christian nation again? But that's not going to help us, just saying that. We've actually got to ask the question, well then, what impact does it have on the way in which we talk about our faith, express our faith, think about our own faith in a world that has shifted and changed? You can't just stand up and tell everybody, but did you know the Bible says you shouldn't do that? Right, that doesn't necessarily play. So, what do we do? I'm going to engage you in some conversation this afternoon, so I hope that's all right with you, because the last thing you want to do is just listen to me rant away at you all afternoon. So I want to throw up these three words, so we go to the next slide, that were in my title today. And to think about Christianity in relation to these three terms. This is simply just one way of thinking about some of this. And these are, I've put question marks at the end of these to make them questions. It's inevitably what that symbol does for us. It's a cultural phenomenon, but it's useful. We've got these ways of seeing our Christianity and our faith in relation to the culture in which we live, to use that term very loosely. We might say Christianity is cultural. It's embedded within culture. It's shaped by its culture. It is defined by its culture. It is expressed within its cultural framework. Or we might say Christianity is countercultural. Christianity is to be different from the world around it, from the culture in which it lives. Christians are to critique prophetically the values and ethics of the world and to stand apart and to say, no, 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 we want to be a different kind of people in the world. We want to be a counterculture to the culture of the world, if we were to use the language of, or the imagery of some of the New Testament. We might talk about in the shadow of the empire, you know, the church and the empire, and how we might hold this prophetic stance and say, yes, these might be the values and the hierarchies and the violence of the empire, but as Christians, we stand for a different set of ethics and ideals and values and beliefs, and we want to live differently in the world. Or we might say, rather than necessarily being culturally embedded or countercultural, we might say Christianity is acultural, which is to say it transcends culture. It's beyond cultural, because we're talking about the realities of God and of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the meta-narrative of Scripture, and that actually transcends the different cultural frameworks that we come from. We might even use the language of kingdom culture. You know, we all come together in church, and here we're part of the kingdom culture, which is to say in some way we believe that Christianity transcends the different cultural experiences and frameworks that we come from, that we're willing to let some of that go so that we might participate in what it means to be a Christian community. So there's three statements for you. Christianity is cultural, Christianity is countercultural, or Christianity is acultural. What I'd love you to do, maybe in threes or fours, that sounds like a good number, groups of three or four, which of these statements do you agree with most? Which do you find most appropriate for thinking about Christianity, faith in the church, in its relationship with culture around it? Cool? Is that clear? Wonderful. Go to it. Hello again, it's me.
It's too late now.
Yeah, yeah, I've started you off. There's no coming back. So we'll turn our attention back towards the larger group. To me is what I'm trying to say. All right, interesting conversation, I think. Interesting discussion. Hopefully your conversations were interesting. If they're not, if they weren't, it's your fault. So, Lloyd's got a microphone here. What I'd love is if just there's anything that came up in your group that you'd like to share with the room in relation to these. What do you think? What did you guys think about this? So chuck your hand up if you'd like to share. Yes, down the back. Let's start there.
I think it's fair to say all of the above. But they've all got, so Christianity is cultural. Are we talking about, because I can guarantee Lloyd's church and my church have got different cultures. I can guarantee that myself and Frosty have got different cultures in terms of Christianity. So Christianity has got its own culture, but then is Christianity a part of the underlying culture of particularly Western nations, or not even particularly, I mean, on the news the other day, there was a report in Samoa that the Muslims are coming under attack because 90% of Samoa are Christians. And so there's a whole nation that is fundamentally founded in a Christian culture, and please don't shoot me, but are 90% of Samoans actually Christians, or are they ticking a Christian box, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. So what is the culture? So, and so again, don't shoot me, but watching MasterChef Australia last night, one of the contestants is frantic because something might have gone wrong, and I'm praying that this hasn't happened. Well, I don't know if she's a Christian or not, but just that phrase, I'm praying, indicates some kind of Christian culture in there. And so it's... Sorry? It could be, agreed. But issue of any faith, it's just that point that there is a culture that underlies all of us that even non-Christians or non-faith people wouldn't want to admit to, and yet they're happy to say, oh God. sorry, I'm just being a little bit cheeky. there's a culture in there, and so Christianity, it's definitely countercultural, or it should be countercultural in that sense, and it should be acultural, and so it's all three, but it's a whole lot more complicated than just that.
Okay, anyone else want to add to what Peter's saying? You know, I think there's some interesting insights there. Yep. Anyone else? Add to that? More you want to say? More?
All right. This group.
Yeah? You put your hand up and then give the mic to someone else. That's the best strategy.
Okay. Well, we thought it was also a perspective view because the kingdom is acultural because it transcends all cultures. We appear to be countercultural because what we say is different to what the culture of the day says. So I guess, again, it's the whole... We have a culture. It's an aculture because it transcends all cultures. But because of that, we are looked at as countercultural, even though, in fact, we're not necessarily revolutionaries in the sense of we have a belief. This is our kingdom. This is what we belong to. But the world would perceive that as countercultural. So, yeah, all three.
All right, okay. Good, thanks, Frank. Awesome. Anyone else want to add to this? Yeah.
Just looking at it now, I'm just having a simple term example. Christianity as culture was past. Christianity counterculture is present. Christianity aculture is... Or, so that's just a simple version of what I wrapped up. The A represents to me heaven on earth. So.
Okay.
I remember back when the revival, I guess you could call it a revival, started at Queen Street AOG. It was back in the 60s. And the culture in the church, and I'm talking about the church, but I guess in a lot of the Christian churches, was women wore hats and men wore suits and ties. And all these hippies started coming in. And they were dirty, and they wore holy jeans, and they were definitely countercultural to the church.
Yes.
And it was interesting because the big discussion was, what are we going to do with these people? If they're saved, do we cut their hair? Do we get clothes that haven't got holes in them? You know, and fortunately the leadership listened to the Holy Spirit, who said, leave them alone. And so they grew to maturity like that. But I think within each church too, there's a culture just as there is in a family.
All right, cool. Yeah, more. Yes.
I think a lot of our discussion was around the fact that probably the third statement was the most accurate, in that Christianity was applicable, that God designed a way of salvation for all mankind. But what I was going to add was this, that a large part of what defines culture is what is acceptable in the way I relate with my fellow man. Christ had a lot to say about loving your neighbour, treating others as being more important than yourself. So Christianity still has the ability to define culture in 2017 as people see how Christians relate with others, how Christians gain or do not have possessions, how Christians relate with their own possessions, with their families, with their fellowships, and with people they find difficult to get along with. So Christianity is a culture driver rather than the other way around. Whether Christianity at the moment is countercultural, I don't think it's seen as that by the men on the street at the moment, because generalising Christianity now, a lot of Christians aren't that different from Tom, Dick and Harry down the street, in the way that they relate with others, in the way that they hold positions, in the way of what they see as important in their everyday lives.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else? Last chance. All right. Thank you. Some really interesting insights and discussions there. And, you know, what you can see immediately is this is kind of simple and complicated at the same time. Right? So you'll go, oh, yeah, all three. And, you know, in some sense we would, you know, the prophetic role of the church, for example, in a wider society, you know, sometimes, well, for me, growing up in a Pentecostal tradition, prophecy was more like, you know, for ye even, God would say unto ye, that your life will be like this, or, you know, you'll do that. It was that very personal, edifying kind of prophecy. I got one, I remember, at a prophetic meeting when I was 16, that I was going to be very successful in sports. I'm still waiting for that to play out, but God moves in mysterious ways, and we'll see. I'll just keep believing. You know, that's one particular way we think about prophetic, especially if you're from a Pentecostal, charismatic type church. But there's a broader sense in which we think about the prophetic as well. If you think about a prophetic stance to the world that you see held by, sometimes successfully, most of the time not, by the nation of Israel in the Old Testament, by the prophets of Israel, who didn't just speak to a church community or to an individual and say, God loves you and has got a wonderful plan for your life, but spoke to nations and spoke to social and political realities and said, you know, there's a different way to live in the world. So there is this prophetic stance that the church is to have in the world, I think. And yet, as the context shifts and changes, that can look very different. And you know, if we are saying, "Hey guys, maybe we shouldn't shoot each other in the streets," in some contexts that would be a very countercultural thing to say, and in another context that would be a quite normal thing to say. So the way the context shifts and changes depends on maybe what becomes countercultural or not. I think you're also right that there is this belief we have that that the kingdom of God in some way transcends all of the different cultures in the world. Because we're not just talking about ethnic cultures here. We've already acknowledged we're talking about church cultures. We're talking about family cultures, friendship cultures. You know, we're using that word to describe all sorts of things, using it very imprecisely probably. And the kingdom of God, the gospel of Jesus, somehow invites us into a bigger story than that. And yet, the only way we experience that story is through the cultural context in which we live and inhabit. You can't get to kingdom culture without being you. And you are inevitably cultural to some degree. Right? You are shaped by that story. So yeah, I agree with you, all of the above. What I do think is, for me growing up in church, I think maybe the first one was more often described in terms of sort of compromise. You know, oh, the church is if the church is aligning itself with the culture of the day, then it's compromising. And so what we need to be is either countercultural or kingdom cultural. But I think maybe that's an oversimplification of what's going on. In fact, even when we say, for example, hey, this is kingdom culture here, well, of course, what we mean is our version of kingdom culture, shaped inevitably by the particular cultural framework we've got. So if a church has a kingdom culture, it has a kingdom culture that is shaped usually by the leadership of the church. And if they're a bunch of white men, kingdom culture will be shaped inevitably by that, right? That's not to say there's not something bigger going on, but that the way in which it's experienced is embedded within particular locations, contexts, cultures, and times. The Christian story itself, right, is embedded within a particular story. We were hearing about story this morning, and there's this big story, but that big story is also the story of God at work in particular stories that are embedded within particular times, spoken in particular languages. The gospel is centered around the story of Jesus, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And we can think about Jesus as this transcendent Christ, but we also think about Jesus as a first century Jewish carpenter wandering the dusty streets of Israel and Palestine in the first century. He saw the world a particular way because of that, experienced the world a particular way, and people experienced him in a particular way because of that. Even our understanding of the term Messiah or Christ is shaped by the story of Israel and what it is that they were desiring and hoping for, liberation from God, from their oppression and from the injustice that they experienced. That was shaped by a particular cultural narrative. So, yes, I think we hold a critical stance towards our culture in some kind of way. But I think we probably fool ourselves if we think we are standing apart from our culture and able to look at it and critique it as if we're not also in it. Right? Miroslav Volf talks about this idea that we, as Christians, we live with one foot in and one foot out of our culture, and maybe even that's an oversimplification, but it's this idea that, yes, I might want to critique the values and ethics and ideas and beliefs of my culture, but I also do so as someone shaped by that very same thing in some kind of way. Right. Are you with me? Yeah? You okay? Yeah, good. In fact, this is part of the news of the incarnation itself. God does not stand far off, detached from our experiences as they are located in particular places and at particular times. God, I think I've got that on a slide here. Yes, God incarnates as human, which definitively locates the gospel story within human cultural realities. God does not simply just appear from the clouds and speak to all mankind and womankind and say, this is the truth, now believe. The way in which God rescues us from our mess we make of our lives is by incarnation, is by entering into the human experience and entering into a human cultural experience. So, why are we talking about all of this, and how does it help, and where might we go? Well, let me quote Medina again. No, that's me. That's quoting myself. Go to the next one. Yeah, people's culture provides the specific conceptual framework for understanding, interpreting, and appreciating the gospel message and the reality of the divine. You can see this play out in the New Testament. So, when Jewish people were trying to make sense of this Jesus, they did so with the symbols and the ideas and the beliefs that they had at their disposal, the language that they spoke, the way they understood. At times, they're reaching for metaphors to try and grasp the profound nature of what has taken place in the life and story of Jesus Christ. Metaphors like redemption, which are not just Christian words. They're words that spoke to them in their time. They were metaphors that they grasped and understood. The redeeming of a slave from slavery carried a potent image in it for how they might understand the work of Jesus in the time. And so, and then the gospel spreads into the Greco-Roman world, into Gentile communities. And you can see Paul wrestling with, how do I talk about this? And he's the right person to do it, I think, because he in some way translated himself into both worlds effectively as a Roman citizen and as a Jewish teacher and as a Christian. But he's negotiating, oh, right, now there's a church in Ephesus and they've got all sorts of issues that are arising because of the issues that are at play in Ephesus. So how do I help them make sense of the gospel within that context so that their lives might be transformed by this gospel but in their cultural context? Which is not giving in to a culture, it's simply recognizing that it is, and you can't escape it. And in fact, that's a beautiful thing. You wouldn't want to, I don't think. For starters, it's God has created us different. So if we were to simply wipe away our difference and make us all the same, well, we would only like that if the same that we were all made was the same that we were. So yes, God is going to make us all one culture as long as it's mine. But actually, it's in our diversity that there is this beauty of the kingdom of God. Now, when we start to think about the engagement of our lives with others, and we think about, you know, your roles as chaplains and all of us as ministers in some way of the gospel in whatever shape that takes, we then need to think about the context in which we find ourselves and how we make sense of our faith, our gospel, and our context. One of the things we might think about in New Zealand, for instance, is, if you go to the next slide, biculturalism. Right. Now, I think last year's conference you had Jay come and speak to about Te Tiriti o Waitangi, or the treaty. In fact, today is a really momentous day down at Parihaka. Not sure if you're aware of the story of Parihaka, where a non-violent protesting community in Taranaki were overrun by... Well, it's a complicated story. But overrun by government troops, and the village was burned. And, you know, it's a tragic story of what colonial forces did to indigenous Māori in that community, who were powerfully and profoundly protesting against what was happening to them through non-violent means. And today, the government is making a formal apology, and there's a reconciliation process that's undergoing between the Crown and Parihaka and the community there. This is all a part of the story of New Zealand, the context in which we live, and it's a complicated one. Our story as a nation is grounded in this partnership, or this attempted partnership, between Māori and non-Māori. I think at least one of the things, I'm going to talk a little bit more, some of my research in my PhD was focused around faith and spirituality and social challenges and transformation and Māori and Pentecostalism, all that kind of stuff. So I'll talk a bit about that and how it might be relevant for us later on today. But I think it's really important for us to recognise the context in which we live and how that does shape our narrative and shape our story. That this was not always well understood, has not always been well understood by the church. We've not necessarily negotiated this particularly well. You know, there were many brave and bold missionaries who came to New Zealand to spread the gospel, and they did. But they also spread civilization, which might have been helpful at times, and in other ways, less so. And so for them to be Christian was perhaps, well, at first, let's just get you put a suit on, which takes us back to our hippies in Queen Street. It's probably my dad wandering through at some stage. You know, what does Christianity look like? And for some of those missionaries, it looked like being an Englishman. And that had an impact on the way in which the gospel spread among Māori in New Zealand and has shaped the conversation here. You know, numbers of Māori converted to Christianity in those early years leading up to and beyond the signing of the treaty. But then in the decades that followed, as the incoming settler population swelled very quickly and land was taken, and everything that inevitably followed that process, you know, one of the refrains from Māori leaders at that time was that the missionaries taught us to turn our eyes towards heaven, and while our eyes were towards heaven, they came and took our land, you know, under our feet. And so there we see the way in which Christianity has been tied up with some really unhelpful ways of seeing culture. So as people who want to take some form of responsibility for ministering to those in the community and the society in which we live, I think there is a profound importance placed upon us to understand the story of which we are a part. Not just the story of the gospel, and not even just my story, but what is the story of my community? What is the story of my wider society? How does that shape the way in which people experience their lives? How does that shape the way people experience me? If I go to talk to someone for whom Christianity goes hand in hand with the tragic history that has caused devastation to their peoples. Let's say that as a generalized statement. If that's who I'm talking to, they might not be that responsive initially to me saying, "Do you know what? If you just give your life to Jesus, everything will be amazing." Because their experience might tell you that that's not how it played out for them and their family or their history. Is this making sense to you? Yeah. Okay, so even in contemporary church life, I don't think necessarily we've got our heads around this particularly well. I think one of the things that happens for us is that, especially if you are a part of the dominant culture, is that you are much more blind to your culture. One of the exercises I often get students that are in class is to get them to share with their neighbour in class. Say, three things you should know about my culture. To sit down and share those things back and forth. Now, one of the fascinating things that always happens, every single time I do this, is that the Pākehā students, the white ones, don't know what to say, usually. Unless they are maybe from another country, you know, so they're Dutch or they're German or South African or whoever they might be. Jackie, English, South African, right there. Got a few Saffas around, don't we? But many of the sort of New Zealand European, if we use that census category, students go, "Oh, I don't really have a culture, so I don't know what to say." So maybe they'll talk about their family, like that, which is fine for the exercise. Whereas a Samoan student, a Tongan student, a Maori student, an Indian student, a Korean student, are able to say, oh, here's three things you should know about my culture. Because when you're a part of the dominant culture, you are in many ways blind to all of the things that make your culture your culture. I became really aware of this when I did a few years of night class learning Te Reo Māori, and as a part of that, you know, I sat down. I remember sitting in my first class, and I'm a bit nervous, feeling, you know, a little out of place, which was unusual just for starters. And I suddenly became aware that I don't usually feel out of place in that kind of way. And that made me think, oh, there must be people who feel a bit out of place all the time. And that was just sitting down in the seat to start, and I was like, I think this is going to be good for me, you know. And then we started, you know, doing songs and games with actions and dancing, and I was so uncomfortable. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to. Come on. And that told me something, not just about other people's cultural framework, but about my own. I suddenly became aware of myself in a different kind of way. It's the same way that, you know, I don't have an accent. But other people do. Yeah. So Jackie's got an accent. Peter, you could hear his accent coming through before. Not me, though. I just talk like a normal person. And if you're a part of the dominant cultural framework, you don't see your own accent just the same way that you don't see your own culture. So I'm sitting on a marae, and you know, we're there for a weekend, and the Friday night is pretty much entirely taken up with doing a poster for our team and coming up with a team song. And I was like, but when are we going to learn some stuff? Come on, let's, you know, speed this up a bit. Get this cranking. Let's get to the point. Which again, immediately highlighted to me, not just what was going on around me, but what my culture was. That my cultural framework was one that valued getting to the point quite quickly and getting straight into it and not wasting time with relationships and things like that. let's get on with it, you know? So one of the things then that happens is that oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, it's those who are in the dominant culture who then get a real heart for ministering in their communities and then find themselves thrust into a world that looks quite different, perhaps to the family they grew up in or the context they're from. And we need to think about that carefully. Otherwise, we can find ourselves being unhelpful rather than helpful. If I'd have jumped up and said, hey guys, I'm really, you know, it's great that we're here, but we don't want to waste our time doing an hour-long songwriting and poster-making thing. If we could just jump straight to the teaching us some vocabulary, that'd be great. That would be a very unhelpful thing to do in that context, let alone then if I was actually going to be the one who was supposed to be helping minister to others. So, as the church, what does that look like? As the church in the community, what does that look like for us? How do we take some of these issues seriously and be a little reflective about what context we're actually coming from, which we're often blind to? So we're going to have a bit of discussion around some of those questions again shortly, so you can look forward to more talking. Okay, so in New Zealand we've got this bicultural story and context that grounds us in this particular treaty partnership, in this particular relationship between Māori and in the first instance Pākehā and the Crown, and then really everyone else who's turned up since, right? There have been a lot of people turn up since. So if we go to the next slide, we've also got this emerging multiculturalism that's taking place in New Zealand. So that then changes the context again in which we operate and live. And in fact, it's not just that there are many cultures here in New Zealand now. You know, the immigration policy used to be that we would take people from Britain and maybe occasionally a few people from somewhere else. Then it shifted and changed in the 60s in particular, or post-war years, to opening up borders to Pacifica peoples to come from Pacific Islands, in particular to meet certain labour demands that New Zealand had at the time. Then in the 80s, the thing that shifted and changed again, and then it became about meeting certain job skills and income and money, and so that opened us up to all sorts of other parts of the world, through Asia and India and so on. And so since that time, particularly if you live in the Auckland region, but also right across the country, we've now got a very diverse community. And it's not just that, as I said before, that there are multiple cultures present, but that these all inform and shift and change and are in fact formed in relation to one another. If we just went back to the Māori Pākehā one for a moment, prior to the first white people turning up, Māori weren't thinking of themselves necessarily as one people. They were thinking of themselves in terms of tribes and in the way in which they related to one another. Then when all the Pākehā started arriving, it's like, hang on, we all might be different from one another, but we're certainly all much more similar to each other than we are to you lot. And so we actually form our identity in relation to one another as well. Michael Wilkinson, who's a Canadian sociologist, sociologist of religion, talks about the fact that migration itself changes ethnic self-understanding. So if you come from one ethnicity and culture, you move to another country, your own self-perception changes because you're now in an entirely different context. Let's say you've gone from being dominant culture to now being a minority. Well, that changes your whole perspective on the world and your whole perspective actually on yourself. Your own identity shifts and changes. Perhaps you never used to walk around going, I'm, you know, white. Yes, and I'm really aware of it. But if I moved to a village in Africa, I probably would become very aware of that fact and be reminded of it every day. You know, so my own self-understanding would change because of that changing context. And then the host culture as well is changed and transformed by that. We are all impacted and affected by what's going on. Now, this is a part of the big question for the world at the moment, right? Which is, do we want our host culture to change? And people are a bit nervous about that idea. And that's a big part of what drove Brexit, for example. We don't want our culture to be changed too much, or at least we're uncomfortable with the potential pace at which it might be changing, and we want to stop it. And there's some understandable fears and anxieties that play out there, I think. And politicians in particular have been, I think, blind to those anxieties and fears that people still hold about one another. There's something difficult about the unknown, about difference. You know, it's all lovely until you have to work it out. And you realise you see the world totally differently from one another. And what is that? And that might be all right if you just live your lives independently, but what does it mean when your kids go to the same school? What does it mean when your businesses are next to each other? What does it mean when you're starting to work out the day-to-day, every, you know, social and political and economic life of your community? So these are the contexts in which I think as Christians who are seeking to minister to those around us who are in need that we need to become increasingly aware of. And perhaps I'll go on to these. I've got six kind of ideas I want to put out there and then have a bit of discussion about them. Because I've been talking in very general terms, but I want to help us think, how does this way of seeing the world and thinking about the world start to impact on our actual ministry practice, chaplaincy in the community, and so on. So let's go to the next slide. So I'm gonna throw six things at you, and some of them will be relatively obvious now that I've been talking. Right. One is that when we are engaging in ministry to others, it is helpful to recognize that I'm coming from a particular cultural context. And to own that, to be aware of that. And to be aware that that shapes my view. That's a really good place to start. Because if you don't think that you're doing that, then you're blind to it and you find yourself running into problems. Sometimes you're not aware of the problems you're running into, but everybody else is. Secondly, then, recognize that my faith is shaped by my cultural context. Now, this is not to say that it is defined by my cultural context or that it is limited to, but that it is shaped by. I was talking to a scholar, a New Testament scholar, who's also spent a number of years in mission work in Brazil, fluent in Portuguese. So he's a New Testament scholar, so he's fluent in, as you can see, first century Greek, English, German, because he's a New Testament scholar and they all have to learn German, and Portuguese. Right, so he's got a few languages going on, but Portuguese is one he's particularly fluent in because he lived in Brazil for, I think it's Brazil, they speak Portuguese. Okay, I've got my country right, I think. And he lived there maybe for 15, 20 years. And one of the interesting things he said in conversation with me is, I think I believe differently in Portuguese than I do in English. Because the language is so different that the words, and not just the words, but then the ideas and the concepts and the nuances and the all of that, that flow out of that language actually mean that his faith takes a different shape in one language than it does in another. That's not to say it's a different faith or that the two are not ultimately faith in the same Christ, right? He's not saying that, but he is saying that somehow in the different locations and in the different contexts and the different languages, it emerges and it shows itself in quite different, it's expressed differently. And it's, again, helpful for us to be aware of that. Yes?
I'm just going to ask a question.
Yeah.
I have a colleague who is a Korean minister.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I'm a bit like you, I don't have an accent. So my faith is pure.
That's right.
In Jesus. I'm saying that facetiously. I still struggle to kind of grasp, understand, and accept that Christianity can be influenced by Buddhism and be okay.
Right.
Can you comment on that?
I can, yeah. Now, I'm not an expert in Buddhism or Korea, but more broadly, I suppose, I think one of the things that happens for us is that we can see the concerning influences elsewhere much more easily than we can for ourselves. So, if I was to say that my Christianity, whether I like it or not, is shaped and influenced by consumerism, that to me kind of sounds, I know it's bad, I know it shouldn't be, but it kind of sounds better than Buddhism. because to me, I'm much more comfortable with the idea of consumerism than I am with Buddhism, you know. So one of the things that happened, for instance, in New Zealand, where the gospel starts to spread among Māori, is that then European missionaries and ministers, and this still happens, start to worry about what's called syncretism, right? Which is where this faith gets blended with this other culture and set of values and ideas and beliefs and so on. But we're usually worried about other people's syncretism and less so about our own because we usually don't see our own quite as well. So if a country has got a long history steeped in a particular religious tradition, I mean, Christianity itself, you know, when Paul says, for example, in him we live and move and have our being. Right? Beautiful, beautiful phrase, speaking of God on Mars Hill. And he's quoting a Greek hymn to a Greek God. Right? So, that's annoying, because I'd rather he wasn't, in some level, right? But what he's doing is he's saying, okay, here's So he walked up to this, you know, the statue to an unknown God, and he uses that as a way of starting to talk about what they don't understand. So could you say that their understanding of God was in some way influenced by their already pre-held religious ideas and beliefs? You can say yes. That's not to say it's defined by that, or that then compromises it. But that I don't think we can escape that in some kind of way. We are all, you know, in the West, because we've got a much longer Christian tradition, we feel more separated from other religious influences upon our faith. But we have different kinds of influences on our faith that shape us just as similarly as Buddhism might in Korea. So I think we always have to be discerning about that and navigate that tension and try and think about it for ourselves. I think a good place to start is to try and pay more attention to what's shaping us that we might find difficult or problematic, and encourage all Christians to do the same with their own cultural frameworks and contexts. That's a brief comment. Next. Recognize that those I minister to are shaped by their cultural context. These might seem like incredibly obvious things to say, but I'm going to get you to discuss them in a minute in relation to your chaplaincy practice. But this is all just to note that there is a complex set of interactions going on whenever we are ministering into particular communities and environments. So I'm coming from a particular cultural context. That is shaping my faith and the way I understand my faith and the way I express it and share it. And then those who I minister to are also shaped by their particular cultural context and framework, beliefs and values and iPhones. Next one, recognize that their perception of me is shaped by their cultural context. So they are shaped by it, and then the way they see me is shaped by it. A couple of years ago at the college, we had a Samoan woman come in to talk to our faculty about how we might get better as a college at working with students from the Pacific and so on. And she was educated, qualified, experienced, and far more experienced in talking about that stuff than any of us were. And yet the experience she shared when she got into the room with us is she stopped by, and at that time we had a Samoan receptionist downstairs, and she stopped to ask the receptionist, "Are they all white?" And our receptionist was like, "Yes, yes, they are." And that made her immediately feel a bit uncomfortable. And then she comes up into the room, and there's a bunch of white people all sitting around. And her experience of that was shaped by the fact that she felt in that environment, coming in as an outsider, coming in as different, and that did impact and shape how relaxed she felt, how open she felt. I mentioned before my wife's a social worker, and this happens all the time in her job, which is that, I hear her talking on the phone sometimes because she'll be working late, as she does, dealing with complex situations. And she's amazing, actually, at putting people at ease from different frameworks than her own. But as I listen to her, I realize what a skill it is that she's developed in her ability to become aware of herself and how that might impact someone else, and so to actually be mindful of that as she engages with their challenges and concerns. Next one, recognize the dominant culture in your society. So, or in our society, what is the dominant culture? And I'm using culture here in a very broad sense, but we might say New Zealand, for example, although it's very multicultural, the dominant framework is still very Western European, right? So how does this impact the lives of those who are not from the dominant culture? One of the things that came as part of my research for my PhD, I interviewed a number of Māori church pastors and leaders around the country, and just asking them about a number of different aspects of life and issues of social concern in their communities and their own faith journeys, and just listening to them talk about their experience, for example, in the education system in New Zealand. And as someone who works in education, I'm totally mindful of, I'm aware of this challenge to negotiate, right? Which is to say, it's designed for people who think about the world in a certain kind of way. So how does that then make someone feel? What is their experience? Now, this is aside from debating what it should be or shouldn't be and all that. That's one issue. But the issue when we're talking about kind of ministry for people is instead of having the big debate about what it should or shouldn't be, at least being able to be aware of what that experience is like for people and what impact that's had on them. Think about someone's entry into the health system and what that's like for them. And so this is something I see a lot. My wife, Hannah. So she's, let's say she's got a client she's working with and they're in the hospital because some kind of medical, let's say they've had a little bubba. The bubba was a bit premature, so they're in the NICU, which is the neonatal intensive care unit. And the family want to visit. And they all turn up, right? Because of course they would. All 24 of them. Now, as a white person, I would never think about doing that. But their experience then. Now, can you have 24 people wandering into the neonatal intensive care unit? Probably not. But the way in which often the white medical staff respond to that, as if it's the worst offensive thing anyone can do, and why have you just stupidly turned up here with 25 people, reinforces this notion that you don't really belong here as a part of this. This isn't really designed for you. So what impact does that have on people on an ongoing basis? Are you still with me? Yeah? Because when we think about people's needs, we can think about them on a very personal level, but we also have to think about the social, political structures within which those personal experiences are being had, because they are influencing those experiences, shaping those experiences. Lastly, then, we might say, recognize the importance of intersectionality, which is something I'm not an expert on, but at least very briefly, we could talk about the way in which various things intersect in the lives of a person. So let's use a biblical example, just to, I'm a theologian after all. But if we think about, you know, Jesus meeting a woman at the well, for example. John 4, you familiar with that story? Where's the woman from? Samaria. So what does that mean? Jews, okay. So there's an ethnic cultural problem here between the Jews and the Samaritans. Yeah? There's a barrier, yeah. What else is going on? Gender. Okay, so what's the... Right, men didn't generally just go up and have a chat to women, especially religious leaders, probably. Who has the power in the male-female relationship in the first century? The man. Right. Who has the religious power? And there's at least a barrier here, Jewish over Samaritan. What else is going on for the woman? She's separated from her community. How do you know that? She's there by herself. At an unusual time of day. What else is going on for her? Okay, so she's not following the moral script for the life of a wonderfully stable married person in the first century, right? If she was a man, that would probably be less outrageous, but as a woman in that situation. Right? So you've got these intersecting things all coming together in the life of this one woman. Female, so disempowered. Samaritan, so disempowered. Ostracized from her community, seen as morally deficient, all of these things intersecting in the life of this individual. And that happens all the time. You know, and Jesus, in his amazing way, ministers into this particular situation. I don't always get the way that Jesus goes about these things. He always has weird, obscure ways of tackling situations, talking in mysterious phrases and so on. But he finds a way to minister into the life of this individual that meets her where she's at. Doesn't judge her for all of that. Doesn't reinforce the divisions and the barriers, but finds a way to work them through so that by the end of the story, which is a pretty short story, really, I'm sure it's a summary account, you know. Otherwise, Jesus was very brief when he talked. Her experience is transformed. She is now empowered and going to reconnect with her community, become the one who's the bringer of news. She's the one to whom Jesus reveals that he's the Messiah. He very seldom does that, only on a couple of occasions in all the Gospels, and yet she's the one to whom Jesus does that. Quite a profound story. And I think it's useful for us again to think when we are working with people, what are the intersections of the various things that are going on in their lives? And in particular when it comes to culture, when it comes to power, when it comes to the way in which those dynamics play out. So what does it mean to be not white and poor and a woman? And you can add the layers of intersection. This is not to say let's define ourselves by all of those things, but simply to say if we're aware of some of that, that might change the way we think about engaging with people and what might actually be going on for them. Yeah? So what I would love you to do now, I know we've been going on a bit, so I'm going to get you to have some more discussion, is to think about these six things. It seems like a lot to think about. But how might they inform your chaplaincy practice, these six questions? You think about your act. So going from just theoretically talking about all of this to thinking about the specific context in which you actually function as a chaplain. How do these six questions play out in your particular expression of chaplaincy? Yeah? So I'd love you to discuss that for a few minutes. Go to it. Let's come back together. Now, I think there's probably a couple of things that can happen here when we start to have this conversation. One might be that we start to feel crippled with anxiety about how to actually engage with other people at all. Because it all starts to feel too complicated. My hope is that that's not where this takes us, but it does come to a cultivating of awareness that these things are going on. And to learn how we, to develop curiosity in ourselves too. In all of our interactions, that we are not just the dispenser of all things wonderful and wise. But that even our interactions where we are ministering to others is opportunity for learning and growth and understanding the world. So that's just an overall thought, I guess. But what are some of the things that have come out? Lloyd's got the microphone again. Coming out of your discussions around these. Thoughts, good or bad?
There's a couple of things that stand out about chaplaincy. One, there's the ministry of presence, and two, it is relational. And there are some cultural bridges that I cannot cross. I'm a hospital chaplain. what we have in hospital chaplaincy is we have Maori chaplains because Maori relate better to them. We have Pacifica chaplains because Pacifica relate to them. We have Asian, you understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
So, yes, I can go, I can be with them, but I can only go so far, and then I need to refer. I have a Muslim woman who is a regular in our hospital, and I'm visiting her, get on really well with her, and then one day she told me that within the Muslim faith, women shouldn't talk to men who are not their husbands.
Right.
And I'm, oh, gee, I'm sorry, I didn't know that. And then she said, no, it's okay in a hospital. But if we were out on a street, we can't do that. Now, I've known this woman for years, but I've never had an in-depth conversation with her. Because of the cultural slash religious issues. So from my perspective, while I honour and acknowledge other cultures, there are places I can't go.
Yeah. I think even that is a really important thing to sit with and to be comfortable with. Because what this is not about is pretending that you're learning how to pretend to be lots of different cultures whenever you go to talk. No, because that's not appropriate or helpful, right? But just even that simple fact of awareness that there are certain things I can say and can't say, certain things I can do and can't do unless relationally things shift and change over time, which might open a space for me to play a different role. But I think that's actually a really important recognition. Yeah, okay, anyone else? Thoughts? Yes.
I think number five really stood out for me because where I work is in Māngere, so it's predominantly Pacific Island and Māori in the school that I work in. But the teachers are South Africans and Indians, and so there's a mixture of cultures in there. And I think that whole thing of recognise the dominant culture in your society and appreciating the culture and actually learning about the culture that you are working in will help more than, I don't know if it's right to say there's an ignorance in there where you've come from a different nation and you just assume that because we're the same colour, maybe, that's how we will treat them the same. Mm. That's something that I've actually have come across, but just appreciating that you have to really be relational, just like what he has said, and to build those relationships within that community and understanding that. So I think that really stood out. Mm. And also number three, recognise that those I minister to are shaped by their culture, so appreciating even where they've come from and just that we are all one and the same doing the same thing with children and just the school that I'm in. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thanks. Okay. Peter again. Thank you.
Yeah, obviously all of those six are really important and pertinent and necessary and must be learned and all of those other good things. But I'd just like to maybe, point number four, just add a sub-clause one and sub-clause two. So perception is important, and so recognize that their perception of me is shaped by their cultural context, absolutely. But I think also we need to consider that their perception of me is shaped by their perception of me. I don't know if that's grammatically correct. But so people will hear my accent and assume I'm South African, and I'm actually not. I'm Zimbabwean.
Right.
And so there's that perception. Yeah. And so, well, isn't Zimbabwe just part of South Africa? No, it's not. It's a separate nation. Very different. Mm. But their perception of me is shaped by their perception of me. And my perception of them is shaped by my perception of them. Mm. So we've got a young guy in the church. He's just gone home to India. He's an Indian, fully-fledged Indian. And so when he first got in there, we get chatting and the World Cup cricket's coming up. So he's an Indian, for Pete's sake. He must love cricket. Absolutely hates the game.
Yeah.
And so perception is so important.
Yeah.
And I get that it certainly is shaped by their cultural context, but you go in with preconceptions about them.
Yeah, that's right.
And we've got to be careful of those as well.
Yeah. So, see, what's important here is not that I go, oh, they're from that culture, therefore I know this is what they're like, and they'll see me this way. It still comes back to that, the relationship, the actual learning about one another, the engaging in genuine dialogue and reflection with each other, being aware that those differences probably exist, but not assuming what they are. Mm. And yeah, we stereo, you know, the human brain is wonderful at seeing patterns, right? It's kind of what it's a way of making sense of the world. We create meaning, or at least cope with the world, by kind of lumping things together in our mind so that we know those things kind of go together and those things sort of go together. And that's a very helpful strategy for not being overwhelmed each day. But that also helps us. Sometimes we create stereotypes. I'm sure familiar with those. And you can't help but do it. But if we're aware that that's what's happening, to be able to at least, again, awareness is the important thing, yeah. And an openness to learn about one another. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
Thank you. I have to agree with the young guy down the bottom there. To recognise that their perception of me is shaped by their cultural context. I'm tangata whenua of this land. In part representation of my whānau from up north, but when people see, ooh, aren't they all the same? It's a perception that people will get straight up. You know, Māori are all put in the same package, but we're not. Mm. I mean, we're beautiful people. We're all beautiful people. So I've got to be mindful of that and show the beauty that is already within to enhance it, and to show that there's another side to us. And when I'm in number three, recognise that those I minister to are shaped by, it's the ministering. When I minister to people in the prisons, with Gail at the Wiri Women's Prison, I've got to be also aware of their backgrounds, whether they're Māori or Pacific Island or whatever, because I know where they've come from. You know, and I've also got to not take away from them their tangata whenua, their people of the land sort of scenario. But I've got to just try and help them to accept that they're beautiful, but it doesn't shape that part of who they are. Mm. It's actually something they can actually... My nana always says to me, you come from the best of both worlds. Embrace them. Mm. My children, we're half-castes. So I tell my children to tell everybody we fruit salads because that just cuts everything off. But yeah, it's a perception of me.
Yeah.
Seeing me for, you know, Christ in me.
Yeah.
But also for those I minister to, see who they are for Christ who has made them.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that. And you know, we do not lose, and we should not lose our individuality. Our own identity within this bigger cultural context. We cultivate an awareness of how that stuff shapes us, but it is not us. And each one of us have our own stories, again, and our own backgrounds. I have, you know, a family member, my brother-in-law who's Māori, who has a very difficult relationship with his Māoriness. So if I was to just bowl in and assume that he's wanting to, you know, speak some reo with me, he's not, because he's got, for a whole lot of reasons, got a very difficult relationship with his own, you know, ethnic and cultural past and identity and stuff. And so, again, yeah, people's stories and journeys need to be listened to, that we actually see people. Yes, right. Thank you.
And just thinking of this cultural thing and how when I go into the prison, I don't see who those people are. I don't see that some are brown and some are white and some are really dark. I just love them and accept them for who they are. And it's been a real privilege because they've loved me back. They've opened up. I've had the privilege of seeing a young Indian woman who I've followed through the prison. She said to me once how when we were going through the deep, hard stuff, she looked at me and she shared with me more than she shared with her mother. And I thought, what a privilege to be there for her. It didn't worry me that she was Indian and I was a white woman. And we still have a really close relationship.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. Awesome. Yeah, I think, again, the importance of this is not to, in highlighting difference, it's important that that doesn't become for us, and I think this is a tension that maybe is going on in wider society at the moment, especially for people who have felt marginalized by the system in some kind of way. There is a desire to reclaim their voice and their agency and their sense that their difference needs to be acknowledged. But the way in which society is then dealing with that, I think, is by seeing those differences as barriers that start to get erected between us, rather than being ways in which we might better understand one another and love one another and enter into relationship with each other.
Deal with that very issue is they try to instill it in law. They try to change legal processes to make it work better, and it doesn't work because they're hitting the wrong point. You know, they think if they legislate the change that's necessary, it'll make up for the shortfall that's there, the difference that exists, like between Maori and Pākehā and trying to redo the treaty. Now, I understand the basis of what they're trying to do, you know, I get a bit of an understanding, but just by putting it in legislation doesn't mean anything necessarily has changed.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a difference between saying some legislation might be really appropriate and helpful and right, and then believing that that's going to solve all of the problems. So, you know, I think there is a time for legislation. I think there is a time for you know, treaty grievances to be addressed and for things to take place through those channels. But if we think that will solve all of the issues that we have, it's not going to. And I think this is where faith-based communities, this is where churches' time to shine and to flourish is, because it's not just in the systemic structural systems of society where this stuff gets changed. That's a framework, but it's the grassroots. It's in neighborhoods, it's in people's lives, it's in the day-to-day experiences of people that transformation ultimately takes shape. The legislation helps to shape the environment in an overall sense, but it can't accomplish personal transformation for people. Yeah. Okay, yes? Beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts and insights. It's great to hear from your experiences and what's actually going on in the community. I'm just a theologian who gets to pontificate about these things. And that's very different from actually, you know, I mean, obviously I love people and stuff. you know. But, you know, the stuff you guys, the work you're doing in the community and with people's lives is profound and important and much needed. So I want to encourage you in that. In the session I do later on this afternoon, I am going to get a little more theological. So that might be good too. We'll see where that takes us. We're trying to have some more conversation together. But thanks for participating, sharing. Appreciate it. All right. Thank you.